So I'm breaking up this afternoon into three talks. They're related, but they're distinct to some degree. So talk, I'm afraid I'm going to blitz you a little bit. That's ELF, isn't it? You drink from the fire hose. But I'm really wanting a lively conversation and discussion. I guess if I ask myself, what am I doing? I'm mixing cultural apologetics, which is looking at various current trends all around us today, around the human self and how we're attempting to secure our identities and how this has made us self-obsessed. So cultural apologetics allied to the doctrine of God. In fact, I first told Greg a title which had the doctrine of God in it. And he said, no one will come, which I found quite tragic. But so I got you here under false pretenses in some respects. We're doing cultural apologetics and the doctrine of God and putting them together, bringing them into a conversation. I've come to the conclusion that nothing can break us out of our narcissism except the doctrine of God, the knowledge of who God is. So this is my attempt to kind of bring these things together. So in the first talk, I want to address the God who is not like us, which is very much the starting point, I think, for the doctrine of God. And my argument here is that this is actually very good news for the modern self. Now, to set the stage, I'm a big picture person. Some of you know that. We're going to do some really big picture. I want to talk about what I'm going to call the two cosmologies. The first one I want to talk about, I'm calling the biblical twoism as opposed to the pagan oneism. When we think about cosmology, we're looking at a viewpoint that incorporates absolutely everything with nothing left out. That's a cosmology. And I'm saying there's only two of them. The biblical one, twoism, and the pagan one, which I call oneism. So let's look briefly at them both. First of all, the biblical twoism. And this is premised on a key biblical category, right from the beginning, Genesis 1, the creator and the creation, between which there's an absolute divide, as in there's a real distinction. They are not the same. So this is presupposed in the first verse of Scripture. In the beginning, God created. In the beginning, God was already existing as the uncreated one, and he made the heavens and the earth. So that tells us that God is uncreated being. So that's where the twoism comes in. The creator, the uncreated being, and the created, which is all the rest. And the Bible goes on to reveal this God, who's our creator, as one who is essentially different from humans. Now, we can also look at likenesses, but actually I think we much more today need to stress the differences. He is not like us. And actually, the study of the divine attributes begins to open up this truth for us. Theologians talk about the incommunicable attributes. That is, attributes of God's being that are not transferable to humans because he's not like us. So it emphasizes the difference. So you think of God's infinity. This is an infinite being. He is a being without limitation. All of his qualities, all of his attributes are without measure. Unlike us who are limited creatures, finite beings. So that would be an incommunicable attribute. This is the same with God's eternity. Here's a God who has no beginning and no end. The quality of his life is eternal. Unlike humans, by way of contrast, which have a beginning, a birthday, and a death, the end of their mortal existence. And you could say the same about attributes like his immutability. God is absolute in who he is. He's perfect. He doesn't improve himself. That's quite something, isn't it? God doesn't have to work at self-improvement as we do. And neither does he deteriorate. So God has a number of what we call incommunicable attributes. And these reflect he is not like us. In his essential being, he is other to us. Another way this twoism reflects itself, and this has been key for a theology of knowing God. We actually start in the knowledge of God by saying he is incomprehensible. The way to express God is to say we don't know him fully. We don't know him as he is. We're grappling with the ungraspable. So something about God is beyond our comprehension. So that's why the knowledge of God begins in a paradox. We express him as the great inexpressible. This is true to who he is. So that's the biblical cosmology, this distinction between the creator and the creation. Now let's look at the second cosmology, which is pagan oneism. Again, this is the big picture with nothing left out in terms of a view of the world. And it's a kind of monism. Paganism in all of its forms, it has many forms, says this world, this cosmos is everything. There's nothing outside of it. There's nothing beyond it. Stephen Smith, in his amazing book, Pagans and Christians in the City, puts it like this. Pagan religion locates the sacred within the world. In that way, paganism can consecrate the world from within. It is religiosity relative to an immanent sacred. That's oneism. Judaism and Christianity, by contrast, reflect transcendent religiosity. They place the sacred ultimately outside the world. That's twoism. Now, as I said, there's lots of different forms of pagan oneism. The first form, you could say from the beginning, after the fall, we call nature paganism. This is the ancient pagan way. Here, the sacred was projected onto nature. So you see this in the great mythologies. Apollos, the sun god, Lunar, the moon god. The days of our week, Monday through to Saturday, most of these are after the gods of nature. So you projected the sacred onto nature. That's nature paganism. And I want to show that actually this form of paganism is beginning to make a comeback. I think it's coming back at an accelerating rate. There's a more recent form of paganism that I rather playfully have called ego paganism. We've got nature paganism, but today we're actually working with ego paganism. The self is at the center of everything. And in the phase we're in, the self fills the horizon of our vision, so it's everything. There's nothing that really exists beyond ourselves, our interiority. It's like a whole universe that we're trapped within. Now, when ego paganism started, you could say this was the beginning of secular humanism, it didn't have an explicit religiosity to it. It placed an implicit trust in humans at the center of everything to engineer a better world, but it wasn't a religious commitment. But actually, we are now into the second stage of this ego paganism, which is much more overtly spiritual. So in the 21st century, this old pagan cosmology, the religious kind, is beginning to come back. And we're seeing the rise of what many are calling neo-paganism. It's an old form of oneism in a new dress. And I think we have to understand today ego-paganism and the new religions. Stephen Smith again says, rather than disappearing, immanent religiosity, or paganism as we have called it, has, like Proteus, merely altered its forms and manifestations. And you can see this today. Now, if you want to see what this looks like, I highly recommend a book by a woman called Tara Burton. I don't know if she's a Christian. It's called Strange Rites, New Religions for a Godless World. And if we're really interested today in engaging skeptics, we have to understand the new religions, which are rising very, very quickly. And Tara Burton helpfully researches this explosion of new religions all around us today, here in Europe and in America. Now, we can miss out on this if we get tricked by the fact that most people today identify themselves as a nun, not as in joining a monastery. A nun, N-O-N-E. That is, belonging to no religion, or the spiritual but not religious. This is huge. So you have to fill out a form, your religious affiliation. There's a nun section there, and most today tick the nun. I'm not religious. But don't be fooled. They are religious. It's exploding. Burton writes, our nuns may not be traditionally religious in the sense that either Jerry Falwell or Sam Harris is used to, but they're not exactly secular either. So when we talk about secularism, be careful. It doesn't mean non-religious, even if they call themselves that. Now, these new religions are clearly in opposition to organized religion, and they're very much a reaction against twoism. They're thoroughly oneist and pagan in the way they work. So the point is, there's lots of new religion out there. And Burton calls the form of these new religions remix. I really like that. They're remix. Here's how she describes it. They aren't exactly rejecting religion, but rather remixing it. It's a story of how more and more Americans, she's an American writing for Americans, and particularly how more and more millennials envision themselves as creators of their own bespoke religion. This is my religion. Mixing and matching spiritual and aesthetic and experiential and philosophical traditions. The remixed hunger for the same things human beings have always longed for, a sense of meaning in the world, personal purpose within that meaning, a community to share that experience with, and rituals to bring the power of that experience into achievable everyday life, but they're doing it differently. So important to grasp this. Now, Burton doesn't make this point. I'm not quite sure where she's coming from. But these new religions that are spreading throughout the West are oneist in structure. A lot of them are about interconnectedness. A lot of them talks about energy that runs through everything. And you find this energy in your yoga class, or you get it from drinking moon juice concoctions. There's big business. And the energy you might get from positive thinking, these are spiritual constructs that connect everything. So, we're seeing the rise of these new religions at an accelerating rate. I'd say it's a tidal wave. We have to get to grips with it now. Burton writes, this is of America, but it's true of Europe too, at least half of America, and likely far more, is either a faithful nun, or SBNR, spiritual but not religious, or a religiously flexible hybrid. This, she says, outnumbers white evangelicals, a group traditionally considered among the most influential voting blocs in America, but whose numbers are now dwindling to just 15% of the population. So this new remix of religions is really happening very, very quickly. And it's all driven by the search for meaning. There's a void in the self. Materialism doesn't do it for us in terms of finding purpose and meaning, so we're finding this in the new religion. So, today the choice is still with us. It's always been the choice for humans. Twoism, with this distinction between the creator and the creature and how he has worked so we can be saved, we can know him, or oneism. Stephen Smith again. The choice between a Christian and a pagan society has always remained very much a live possibility. And I think as we think about our culture, we need to think in those terms. So let me look now at why the recovery of twoism is critical for us today, critical for the modern self. The first is this: human identity is grounded in one who is not of this world. Our human identity is grounded in one who is not of this world. And this, of course, is the remarkable anthropology of the Bible. Humans are the imago Dei. We are the image of God. Now, this phrase, I've been thinking about its meaning for decades. And I have to say, I'm still wrestling with it. It's so full. It's inexhaustible to be called the image of God. And I think too hard we've tried to nail it down. There are so many dimensions, so many facets to the idea of being the image of God. One neglected meaning, I think, is to see it's real communication that there's nothing in this world that fully secures our identity. We are the image of the God who is not of this world. It all exists within this distinction, this twoism. Nothing inside the cosmos signifies a human person. Nothing within nature, this cosmos, gets to the core of our meaning and our identity. So it's only the God who is not of this world, the one who's not like us, only he is the ultimate grounding for our life, our meaning, and our identity. And the implication is, apart from him, we can never find ourselves, because we are his image. So the God who is not like us, he alone is the true basis for our value and worth. And if you take him out of the picture, our identity quest is going to become extremely muddled, as I'll show in my next talk. So that's the first. a reason why the recovery of atuism is so critical. Our human identity is grounded in this God who's not like us, not of this world. The second reason is this. Only in atuism can distinction and diversity be maintained. Now, follow my logic here. When you look at the Genesis account, the creation account, you see there that distinctions are central to how God made things. So the word separate is used 5 times. God separated the light from the darkness. God made humans separate from the rest of nature. And he made the woman separate from man with real biological distinction. Now these separations, these distinctions are only possible because God himself is distinct from creation. There's a certain logical flow to that argument that makes a lot of sense. They're grounded in the reality of twoism. The one who is distinct from creation, he makes distinctions. Now, when this God, who is not like us, not creation, when he's removed from the picture, everything collapses into oneness. One ism, in some form or another, becomes a kind of panentheism. And the self gets absorbed into the oneness. It abolishes distinction. That's the point. So the unity, the oneness of the cosmos, is at the expense of our uniqueness, our diversity. Now, I think if you look at what's going on in our culture today, you can see some very troubling symptoms of this oneness cosmology at work in terms of how anthropologies work. Humans are being absorbed into the oneness. Now, I'm just going to cover these briefly, but you see this with naturalism or materialism. This is a oneist cosmology. Everything is matter. Everything is built on the building blocks of the atoms. Now, if humans are only atomic, only biological, then we are one with nature. And all of our attempts to define ourselves in any other way are just illusionary. And that's why today all of our faculties, all our capacities, including our consciousness, the sense of self that everyone carries, the sense that we are not included in this world, we have a sense of self which is not the world, these are just illusions. We are just one with nature. We're nothing more than atoms. And what's going on in our brains is just electrical impulses. It's no more than that. So there we get absorbed into nature. We could say much more there. Now, I believe transgenderism is another outcome of a oneist cosmology. Transgenderism. Because this leads to the abolition of the distinction on the matter of being male, being female. A clear distinction made in the Genesis account. So gender today is very quickly becoming non-binary. Binary means two parts, which in the case of gender is male and female. Non-binary is used to describe genders that don't fall into these two categories. As the LGBT website puts it, some people have a gender that blends elements of being a man or a woman, or a gender that is different than being either male or female. Some people don't identify with any gender. Some people's gender changes over time. My point, oneism abolishes distinction, moves to a kind of blurring of things. Transgenderism, we could say much more, is an example of that. The one I'm really interested in today comes out of the world of cybernetics, which has led to transhumanism. Norbert Wiener is known as the father of cybernetics, and he's actually interested in what connects everything together. And he says, well, nature, the environment, functions like a machine. We're part of nature, so we too are machines. And there must be something, a planetary oneness between humans and the natural order of things. Everything is part of this. So the key to stabilizing humans, he thought, was to study the nature machine system to see how it works to create a new order for the world. He was that optimistic. If we understand the machine order of nature, we can condition humans to behave better. That was Wiener. Now, there are lots of what we might call internet utopians who follow Wiener today. In this human-machine synthesis is a kind of planetary consciousness. There's a pagan kind of idea, a planetary consciousness. It transcends the state. That's where we have to focus things. This has the power to create a better world. Now, more recently, and it's a very serious endeavor, techno-humanists are talking about what they call the great singularity. You heard of this? This is where our biology must merge with the machine, with the nanotechnical, and if we put these two together, we can upgrade ourselves. We have to become one with the mechanical, with the technical. It's the absorption of humans into the machine. It goes back to Norman Vibert again. It's this one machine system that we have to integrate with in order to create a better order. And you could even see the digital world that we're being absorbed into as a kind of oneism. Distinctions very much, we're being absorbed there, distinctions being abolished, it's conditioning us, and it's challenging the uniqueness of human existence. So the issue is this, we can multiply examples. The problem with oneism is it moves in the direction of abolishing distinction, the uniqueness of the human individual. That's what oneism does. And that's why we need the recovery of twoism, which is at the foundation of the doctrine of God. Because that allows for these separations and distinctions. Right, thirdly, the last reason we need to recover twoism is because it's necessary for the rescue we require. Utterly necessary for the rescue we require. I don't know if any person that I'm in contact with, what I call the skeptic, I have many friends who are skeptics in Cambridge, I don't know any of them that would deny that some kind of rescue is necessary. Common ground I can establish is we need saving, and our planet needs saving. I would say 20 years ago you couldn't say that, but there's not many people who doubt salvation, the need of salvation, the need of being saved. Our planet needs saved. This is what the whole Extinction Rebellion thing is about. There's something wrong with nature. Our Prime Minister in England announced that we're 1 minute to midnight. Probably now we're past it. It's too late. It's already being destroyed. How are we going to save it? And then many, many thinkers, secular thinkers, who say humans need saving. There's something wrong with us. So I'm studying what I call secular sin labels. How does a secular humanist label the problem? How do they get at what's twisted and bent out of shape about humans? Now, oneism as a cosmology has to create a story of how the rescue happens from within, because there's nothing outside. So the question of who's going to save us? Nature is in trouble, we're in trouble, who's going to save us? Well, nature isn't going to save us. And despite what neo-pagans say about nature, with its harmonizing energies, nature is utterly blindly indifferent to the human condition. I read an atheist philosopher. He's one of the negative ones. And he said rightly, he said, if humans went out of existence, nature wouldn't give a damn. It wouldn't even know we disappeared. Blindly indifferent, because it's not conscious. It doesn't have human consciousness. It wouldn't even know, and it certainly wouldn't care. So looking to nature to save us is not going to work. And the fact is, I think we're becoming tired of our various ideologies to save ourselves. I think the political has been our salvation strategy for the 20th century. Actually, it goes back into the 19th century a bit. But we've tried so many political ideologies. And I think, I mean, the last hope is that the new radical liberalism, the radical left, will save us. But that's not even a salvation strategy. It's just about total chaos. Just overturn the order, and who knows what will come out of it. I think we've almost come to the end of the age of political ideologies in terms of a strategy to save ourselves. Well, in the Bible's cosmology, the twoism one, there's another rescue story. It's a rescue that comes from the outside. And it can come from the outside because God really exists as the one who's not like us. And God alone has the kind of freedom to mount the rescue. And this is the gospel. He's done that by sending his eternal Son. He sent him from heaven. The Son has entered our space. He's come into our cosmos, being made fully human, going through the full range of human experience. And the remarkable thing about Jesus Christ is that he actually bridges the twoism cosmology of the Bible. He's fully God, the God who is not like us, and he's fully human. He brings both together. And he has, because of that, pulled off the greatest rescue in human history. The point is, without a twoism, we're left inside this oneist cosmology where we have to try and pull off the rescue for ourselves. And I actually think the secular age is exhausting itself with these attempts to save ourselves. I sense this weariness, this cynicism that we can do this. So we desperately need the twoism that the Bible reveals to us, the God who's not like us, and therefore the God who can enter our chaos in the person of his Son, Jesus Christ, to redeem it.